Hello and welcome to BL Podcast. I'm Nivedita Varadarajan and this is The Context. The world is facing a huge climate crisis. Over the past year, we have seen massive wildfires in the US, droughts in Africa and torrential rains in many parts of the world, including India. Obviously, this affects the day-to-day lives of the people, but climate change also has a long-term impact. Public health and finance gets affected, and some people might have to move away from their homes as the place they live in has become uninhabitable. Governments all over the world are now trying to take steps to reduce their carbon footprint, and even corporates are stepping up and cutting down their emissions. The big question now is to how to transform to a low carbon world. I'm glad to invite Anish Day, partner and head, Energy and Natural Resources, KPMG India, to the program. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Nivedita. Glad to be here.
So why should countries shift to a low carbon world? We know that we are all dependent on oil right now. How can countries reduce their dependence on crude oil?
It's not just crude oil. It's actually oil, natural gas, coal. Countries are dependent on a range of fossil fuels. And that's actually been the mainstay of the world's fuel supply for much of history. Okay, it's only that now that we have used up our carbon content, and essentially that comes from burning the fossil fuels or using the fossil fuels, and the world is at a precarious state as a consequence of that because of overheating of the world of the planet. And since we cannot afford the overheating of the planet beyond a certain point, you have to find resources which don't heat up the planet. And that's why you have to move to low carbon resources like solar, wind, and back off from, so to speak, high carbon resources like coal, oil, and some extent natural gas as well. So that's the purpose, because we are at a fairly precarious state from which we need to find a way to extricate ourselves.
So what will happen if the countries can't let go of these, the coal, the oil, and the natural gas?
So we are already at a place where, the world is substantially hotter than before. We are almost at 1.3 degrees above the temperatures in the pre-industrial age, say in the 18th century. So now if we continue, and the pace of heating has increased, it's increasing at an exponential pace. So if we don't do what we have to do, we would not be able to contain it within the targeted 1.5 degree or even the 2 degree centigrade level, which is kind of the failure limit, so to speak. If it exceeds 2 degrees centigrade in terms of the heat as compared to the pre-industrial age, you are going to have even more catastrophic events as compared to what we are seeing today. So more wildfires, more polar ice sheet melting, the seas going up, can go up to even 7 meters, so to speak. Okay, so more methane emissions because, say, the Siberian tundra is going to be uncovered and methane is going to escape into the environment. So we come into a domino from which we will find it almost impossible to get out. So it is, as I said, 2 degrees is limits the fail, kind of indicates the failure level. If it exceeds 2 degrees, 2 degrees is bad enough because we'll have enough and more challenges. We are already seeing that at 1.3 degrees. But if it crosses 2 degrees, then it is going to be catastrophic. And that possibility of crossing 2 degrees is very real.
We need to shift away from oil, coal, and natural gas, but these are the bedrock of energy security. How can countries as a whole move away from these things when they are the bedrock of energy security? And we know that energy security is the most important thing for most countries, especially India. We import 80% of our oil.
Yeah, I mean, energy security is different from supply security. What you are talking about in the first part is supply security. We need to serve our citizens with energy, right? So that's what is required. And if coal and oil and natural gas have been the bedrock of that serving the citizens, then moving away from that is not easy. And you're absolutely right. It is very, very difficult to move away from those sources. But we must, because for the reasons that I discussed earlier, that we must find a way to move away. The question is that how quickly we can, because they've already used up a lot of time. We knew about this problem, say, 3-4 decades ago. In fact, it's been called out much earlier. But at least for 3-4 decades since the Kyoto Protocol, say, for example, 1991, we have known about this and the world has been cognizant of this. 30 years down the line, we haven't really done that much. So now it has become time to kind of do it on a much faster scale than before. It is not going to be easy. It is, renewables today, for example, contribute less than 10% of the global energy. And if you include hydropower, maybe a little more than that, okay? But if you have to make that 10%, 90% or 80% or even 50%, okay, that's a massive, massive change. And I'm not sure how we are going to manage that change, how we get the resources in, but we have to try for it, which means that if we have to do that, we have to scale up renewable energy, solar and wind, but also scale down fossil fuel like coal, oil, and natural gas. I mean, it doesn't mean that we have to shut them down entirely, but we have to progressively scale down, and not just progressively, but at a fairly large, aggressively scale them down. You know, so that is the thing. So scale up of renewables, scale up of scale down of coal and oil aggressively, both aggressively. But there's one thing which has to go. Again, for service security, security supply, because renewables are intermittent, okay, and variable. Okay, so which means that the sunshine doesn't shine in the night, the wind doesn't blow during the calm periods, right? So which means that you have to have energy storage on a large scale, without which just having, this doesn't help, the solar and wind doesn't help. As it happened in case of oil and natural gas, they were much easier to store. So they came sort of with natural storage, okay, for oil and natural gas and for coal, okay. But now we have to build storage systems to supplement the renewable sources, the popular renewable sources, which is the additional challenge because we haven't done this on this scale ever before. So now we have to try that as well.
So how do we build for the future? Will we have an issue while building for the future while we are already facing the impact of climate change, even though it's not that severe yet?
Yes. So short answer to it is yes. That scale up of aggressive scale up, as aggressive as you want it to be, is still a very, very difficult journey. Just understand how it happens. You know, our energy systems for the last 300 years have been built on a paradigm where you could store the fuel, but once you converted the fuel to energy, you had to consume it almost instantly. So whenever the electricity is produced, it is consumed largely at the same time. You don't have storage of electricity on a large scale, maybe small amounts. But now you're talking of flipping that paradigm, right? You're talking of actually generating the moment the wind blows or the sun shines, but then storing that energy substantially. So instead of storing fuel before electricity production, you are producing electricity and then storing the energy. So that whole 180 degree flip of the whole energy paradigm is not easy to implement, especially when you're doing it on a global scale. If you had been doing it locally on a small scale, that is okay. You're doing it very aggressively, very rapidly on a global scale. That means so many challenges. Your systems are not designed, your resources are not designed, your storage resources, say, if you are storing in batteries, whichever form of battery, lithium ion, red acid, everything. Okay, they're not designed for that scale of, resource requirement. Global lithium, quantities of lithium, available lithium are not indefinite, that's limited. Others like cobalt, nickel, all those metals which you require are all becoming very, very expensive very fast at the moment because it's a simple laws of economics, right? Limited production, more demand chasing it means that the prices will go up. So we are in a very difficult place. It's not easy to kind of come around it, but we have to keep trying away. And eventually, hopefully with some effort and some global consensus and efforts by individual countries, including India, despite difficulties, Okay, we might get to a place which is not as bad as it could have been, but it will still be bad.
What are some of the innovative practices? You say we need a 180, we need to do a 180 degree flip on how we store our energy. So are there some interesting new technology which is coming up which looks at how to store electricity?
Yes, so there are multiple technologies. All of them are, you know, essentially we are talking about storage technologies. So, you know, let me talk of a few. First thing is that battery storage, I talked about lithium ion. Okay, that really has been around for our phones, our computers. You're trying to make that much, much more industrial scale, not the small scale, which is individually required by the devices, but network-wide basis. So lithium ion is quite popular as a technology. Lead acid has been old technology, but it is also making its resurgence. There are new technologies, which India is particularly pursuing, things like aluminum air, where you, in using the chemistry of aluminum, you store energy in aluminum and then you release it from aluminum or its compounds. Okay, so there are some innovative technologies which are happening around that. New chemistries will keep developing. It's not a question. That's a good thing about modern life, that you keep developing new things. But some of them will take time. And so we need to see what comes out. So that's a battery technology. The second technology, which has been around for a very long time, but is now scaling up, is pumped storage. So you have, you know, you store water upriver and then you release it in the off-peak hour. So when the sun is out, okay, and you have excess production of electricity, you pump the water up, and then in the night hours, you pump the water down. In simple terms, pump storage.
So that's combining solar energy and hydro energy together.
Hydro energy.
So
together.
Hybrid model then.
Yeah, it's kind of a hybrid, okay? So pump storage works that. Solar, wind, whatever, and then using that. So that's the second thing. The third thing is not on energy system, but actually storing the carbon emitted. So carbon capture and storage, carbon capture utilization and storage, CCS, CCUS, you'll hear about these. So those are also coming in. They are not storage technologies, but you at least store the carbon. Instead of storing the energy, you store the carbon, don't let it into the air. And that way you can continue to run your fossil fuel-based plants. You know, it could be in the coal, it could be natural gas and so on. Now, that technology also been around for a while now, but it's not cost-effective at this time. Okay, so that is where the challenge is. But maybe over a period of time, you know, when more research goes in, more funding goes in, there is greater purpose behind our experimentation, those costs can come down. You know, there is some promise of those costs coming down. Maybe there'll be some technological breakthroughs also, okay, which will help bring us down those costs. Then we might have a balance where we continue to, of course, pursue solar, wind, and other renewables and associated storage. But also we look at the new technologies for old fossil fuel resources like carbon capture and storage, carbon capture utilization and storage. So we are waiting for to see how breakthrough research comes and helps us on that. And it is very necessary. Without that, actually, there is no solution to this problem.
So, but when we are talking about all these new innovative technologies, take lithium batteries, for example, something which you mentioned, mining of lithium is a polluting activity by itself. So where do we strike the balance between mining something for renewable energy versus producing oil itself? Where's the balance?
See, it's not the production of oil is not the problem today, right?
Both are harmful to the environment, right? So where do we draw the line?
So, yeah, that's how I'll answer your question. So CO2 release is our biggest problem, right? Mm. That's a burning platform. So you have to contain the burning platform. And for that, you might have to make adjustments to others, where there might be local pollution and others, okay? So those are the, which is the lesser of the evils you have to choose, given that, you know, planet Earth is on the verge of collapse, which is the lesser evil you need to choose. Okay, that's the first thing. But within that, having done that, is there a better way of making sure that the effluents which come out or the waste which comes out from lithium, okay, mining is contained, you know, it's not as harmful as before. There is lots of technology for that as well, okay? So you need to exercise that caution and find out technologies which causes lesser harm. Similarly, we need to recycle. For example, all the lithium-ion batteries which are produced, you know, they can be reprocessed, recycled to get the lithium and the precious metals out once they're out of their useful life. So we have to practice circular economy principles as well as, you know, environmental principles to the extent that we can, best extent that we can, to limit the damages from mining of resources like lithium. But our burning platform today is CO2, okay, or you know, greenhouse gases, methane, CO2, whichever. And we have to do everything to limit its exposure to the air. Because if we don't, we have almost used up everything which was there in the bank.
So the line is, first stop the house on fire and then we can fix the plumbing. Basically, that's what you're saying.
That's exactly the way to put it.
Let's move on a bit to what India is doing to move to a more sustainable way of having energy. One of the things that I find most interesting is that the Indian government is focusing on ethanol blending in petrol and in diesel. But it's a thing which will work for Brazil, for US. But do you think that will really work in India? Seeing that in India, there's a lot of issues with growing sugar. And as such, it's a water-intensive crop. Should we be intensifying that?
So I think first, let's discuss multiple parts to your question. Let me first take the first part about what is India doing. I think India is doing a lot. Okay, so we have transitioned to renewable energy on a very large scale already. Okay, so we have 100 gigawatts of renewable energy. And if you count the hydro, close to 150 gigawatts of renewable energy already installed. Okay, and that has a lot of it has been done in a very short time frame. We are on course to go to 450 gigawatts. You know, for 2030 is the target. Maybe it'll
do it sooner, according to Prime Minister.
Well, hopefully sooner, maybe a little later, depending on where the need is. You know, it's finally to respond to market systems, and hopefully we'll be there. You know, but sooner than later. Okay, so we are doing a lot on that, and we have been committed even when the prices were high for a relatively poor nation. We have been very, very committed to that. Okay. So that's a positive side of things. On whether that is enough or not is a question. Of course, before that, we also need to recognize that we have almost stopped setting up new fossil fuel-based plants. Okay, so if you look at it, up beyond what is already under construction, nothing new, no fossil fuel-based plant is getting financing, right? So we are already doing a lot from that standpoint. Okay, now, motives can be, somebody will say renewables are cheaper than fossil fuels, hence it is okay. There could be financiers are not willing to find fossil fuels because, you know, they see it as a dead loss down a few line, a few years. So that might also be a motive, but that's the reality. We are scaled up renewables. Coming to ethanol, okay, ethanol has a slightly different motive. Okay, it is not just about climate change.
Like it's to not pay that huge bill to the Middle Eastern nations.
Just look at that. This is where we come to energy security rather than supply security. You know, we are massive. We are importing more than 85% of oil and 50% of our gas. And we are growing in terms of consumption. Our consumption basket is increasing as we go forward because, you know, we are in that stage of development as a nation. Even if we don't do anything, we'll grow at 6-7%. Okay. So that energy requirement for meeting that growth is significant. And we are becoming very, very susceptible to not only supplies, but also prices. If you look at global gas prices, for example, last 3 months, they've just shot through the roof. Okay. Yeah. Oil prices are also much higher than what they were just a year ago when that, of course, collapsed. Okay. Today, $75, $80 per barrel is what we are paying for oil imports. Okay. So that's very, very expensive. And it can cause damages to our whole economy. And honestly, it can oil prices can go up further. If investments in upstream oil don't happen, say, because Europe is not willing to look at upstream oil funding oil projects, you know, Shell, BP, everybody's under, you know, under stress. Exxon's board has been pushing back on new investments in oil. So we've seen the press around that, you know, where they had activists joining the board. Okay, so when you see all of that and the investments going down in upstream oil and gas production, your prices will go up because, you know, the change in consumption doesn't happen so quickly. Okay, as a consequence, India as an importing nation is very, very exposed. And for that reason, you need to look at alternatives. That is why solar and wind are also so important for us, because this gives us a modicum of security, even if it comes with inconveniences. Okay, and that is why ethanol is so important as well. That's why you'll see green hydrogen coming, green methanol coming, all of these coming, because at least we can use our indigenous resources and not be so badly exposed. We'll still be exposed. You know, there's no way to completely, you know, cut out our oil imports and natural gas imports, but at least we need to limit that. So it's a lot more on energy security, as much on energy security as on environmental grounds that we are doing ethanol. Now, coming to the production of ethanol, see, I think we have some room over there. And I know sugarcane is water consuming and others, but we need to improve our cropping techniques so that we can limit the use of water to the extent that we can, okay? And hence, you know, make it much more efficient. And there have been techniques in which I practice. South India has now totally gone into drip irrigation and other modern irrigation in various parts for various crops, okay? So maybe even in sugarcane, we'll have more research going in to make sure that, you know, the water consumption is minimized. It will still be a water-intense crop. It's not going to go away. But biofuels as a category will remain important for India, both for environmental purposes and economic purposes and supply security purposes, as I said. So that's the motive through which you have to see. And if we can make a small dent, you know, even a 3%, 5% dent to oil imports because of that, that's a big achievement. You know, that's going to ask for a lot of biofuels to do that. The other thing which you must remember is that biofuels, even if the price is a little high, okay, it might not be very high in the context of increasing global prices of oil and gas, but then the income is going to your farmers, right? So which politically it makes a lot of sense.
Okay, so there's one thing when we're talking about biofuels, it hit me that we usually don't talk about sewage and recycling in that and get energy off that. Why isn't the government concentrating on it as much as we should?
There are efforts to do that. Currently, there is various kinds of technologies being talked about for treating sewage, you know, and using it for energy production. So, for example, the NTPC, the large generator, you know, thermal power corporation, is using refuse-derived fuel for making briquettes and co-firing its power plant at near Delhi in Dadri. Okay, similarly, there is a process of converting biofuels at municipal waste to, you know, CO, carbon monoxide and hydrogen, you know, so that's, you know, syngas, it's called syngas. So there are efforts going on, and from there, hydrogen is being separated out and things are being done. It has not acquired the scale yet, okay, because this is not easy. It's very dispersed, and our waste collection, waste treatment processes are not the most modern. You know, we don't have those practices in India. Our municipalities are also very old-fashioned, and you know, there's a whole mafia around waste which operates. So all of those factors contribute to the slowness, but the intent is there.
One more thing I want to talk about is the government's push for electric vehicles. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So electric vehicles is a part of both modernization and decarbonization. Okay, first thing is that modernization of our cities has become necessary because, especially in the polluted environment that most Indian cities have, you know, this has been a major, major blot on the country. Okay, and but there are many reasons for pollution. It's not just vehicular pollution, but vehicular pollution is quite significant.
A chunk, yeah.
Yeah, vehicle pollution is quite significant. And going to EVs helps us deal with the local pollution aspect. So if you see a city like Delhi or Chennai, you know, wherever there's major vehicular pollution, going to EVs will help with the local pollution. But that doesn't necessarily solve the larger, wider CO2 effects. Okay. And then that can be solved when we actually have more renewable energy generation, which is what we are moving towards, and EVs coming in for transport. So when you have a coupling between the source of generation and the use through EVs, okay, for of that electricity, green energy through EVs, then it serves a CO2 problem as well. Okay, that's the second part. The third part is modernization of technology. India has been an auto hub since the last 20 years, quite a strong, large auto hub, maybe 25 years now. Okay, and if the automobile industry is going to globally move towards EV, which is the indication, then India also ought to move towards EV, because we want to remain a production hub for autos. And one of the reasons why you can remain a production hub is because if you have a home market, which is also strong, you know, India home market is reasonably large. Yeah. So multiple factors, okay, contributing to the government's EV push. But having said that, we haven't made that kind of progress yet.
So there are two aspects in my mind when we look at EV, how the government is pushing the private EV consumption and how the government is pushing for public consumption. Public consumption, I mean, for public transportation. So in my mind, it seems like the government should move towards helping the public transport become more energy efficient, so more people will come to that, and not incentivize, I know that's a wrong word to use here, but not to incentivize EV for private use enough, because then there'll still be traffic on the road, there'll still be a lot of issues related to that.
Yeah. So two parts again to that question. One is the electric part of the question, and the other is the public versus private transport debate. And I'll answer both parts of it. Now, so electric public transport, you know, it comes in three or four forms. You know, it is buses, okay? It is three-wheelers, because India is full of three-wheelers.
Autos, basically.
Autos, yeah. And then the taxis, okay? Mm. These are the three. The fourth category would be city goods and, you know, light pickups and so on and so forth. So it depends on the duty cycles. So all of these have reasonable duty cycles, and more you'll see conversion to EVs as we go forward. This is in the public transport space, okay? And this is good in every way. I mean, we ought to have better public transit buses and so on and so forth, but be that as it may, you know, within that, assuming those constraints on public transport, moving to EVs is something which is going to happen in the next 4-5 years at a very quick pace, okay? Even two-wheelers, which is private transport, is moving quickly there, because actually it's much more convenient and economical to have an electric two-wheeler as compared to a traditional two-wheeler. Okay, you can plug it at home and charge it. You don't have to go to a petrol bunk and wait there. Okay, so as a consequence, you're going to see offtake of two-wheelers are going up. Now, whether it's good for or bad, you know, that's a different matter. But we have a culture of two-wheelers, personal transport, which has grown up over the years. It's better to have it in electric rather than in the conventional fuels, better for pollution, better for oil imports, and so on and so forth. So that's the second part of the thing. Private cars will be the last, okay? Because duty cycles are very, very limited. My car doesn't run 10 kilometers a day on the average, right? Mm. Or maybe just about that, or maybe 15, okay? So that duty cycle doesn't justify my moving to an EV purely in economic terms. I can still go, you know, because it might be good to, good by my image, good to do it as a social responsibility, moving away from fossil fuels, but otherwise it doesn't make sense. So that category in general will be the last to move to EVs, okay? Public, private cars at large. Coming to public transport, I think we have electrified our public transport already very significantly. So if you see all the metro rail projects which have come, that's nothing but public transport, electric public transport on a very large scale. Okay. And in the last 10 odd years, 15 odd years, we have seen massive proliferation of metro rails across all cities. Okay. So to that extent, I think there is a lot of credit which we don't claim. We always look at buses when we are talking about and say that our bus transport hasn't, you know, gone electric, or it hasn't become as good as it ought to be. But our metro rails have become much, much better, and they're all electric. So I think we have already moved a lot of it to electric already, and we don't claim the credit for it.
India is still relatively dependent on coal, and we are importing coal. We usually import coal from, dirtier coal from other nations to fuel our energy needs. We know, and you also said that India is moving towards solar more and more. When will we see solar come in power with coal?
In terms of more capacity or in terms
capacity
of
capacity generation and usage?
So I think, as I said, we are making very good progress. Now, you again mentioned about imports. So there is imports of coal and there is coal. Imports of coal have come down quite sharply, unless it's a coastal station which was meant for imported coal. So we have some power stations along the coast of the country, which were designed for imported coal, and the contracts are there for imported coal and so on. So leave those out, because those were by design meant for imported coal. But for other power plants where we used to have a lot of blending of imported coal with domestic coal, I think that's come down. Okay, that's come down quite significantly, and the government is very clear that it does not want to import coal for these power plants. Okay, eventually we might even see the other power plants importing less and using domestic coal wherever that's, you know, affordable also. Okay, so we might see even the imported coal-based power plants making a shift eventually. Coming to when will solar become at par in terms of energy content with coal? It's a long way away. Okay. So our coal-fired capacity is about, you know, 220, 230 gigawatts, whatever is the latest number. Okay. As compared to that, our solar is only, you know, say whatever, 40,000 megawatts, 40 gigawatts or so. Okay. So it's already, coal is in a factor of 6 more than this. Now coal's utilization factors are also higher. You know, solar will have a capacity utilization factor of, you know, say 20%, okay? And coal will have a capacity utilization factor of 60%. So it's 3 times. So if you put, 6 into 3, 18 times, so it's solar energy generation is 1/18th. By that arithmetic, by 1/18th of coal. So even if we scale up, so we have to scale up solar 18 times to get to par with current coal. Roughly.
So that's a long way off then. We're still
so
decades
long, away. Long way. Yes. So
there's one more interesting aspect which I want to talk to you, which we usually don't consider while talking about a low carbon energy, that is nuclear power. Where does India stand in that? Many nations in the world are moving completely away from nuclear power because they believe that, you know, they have their own politics, and they also say that it's waste they have to keep and store, goes on for a long time. So should India be using nuclear power?
Yes. So I think if we have to look at all low carbon sources, if we had to make a rational choice, okay, then nuclear should be a part of the mix, because we need baseload generation, you know, solar and wind themselves will not suffice, okay? And batteries will be taking a lot of time, and a lot of batteries, and they have their own problems of recycling. So if you had to take a very rational decision, then nuclear should be a part of the mix. But nuclear has had major challenges because, and of course, safety is a big issue, and Fukushima, that disaster didn't help at all, you know, that has, you know, done nuclear across the world great amount of damage. And even today in India, when we talk about the large nuclear complexes, you know, be it the existing ones like Kunalkulam or others, or, you know, Jaitapur, where it was talked about in Maharashtra, there's a massive amount of local resistance to say that, you know, we should not have nuclear. So nuclear inherently faces resistance, okay, which it is not easy to avoid that. Because climate change is not here and now, maybe 20, 30 years we'll get affected, maybe beyond that, okay? And nuclear people fear it right now.
Today, it can happen anytime, yeah.
Yes, yes. And also it involves large land acquisition and so on. So when you mix A and B together, the fear and the fact that your land is getting taken away, people become very impassioned with their sentiments about the sentiments on nuclear. But if you have to take those passions away, then it is worth doing. About waste treatment, nuclear waste treatment, it is a challenge, but the waste treatment methods have also improved over a period of time. It's a technically solvable problem. It is not that it is an unsolvable problem. So, but you know, there are lots of steps to go before we come to the waste issue. Fundamentally, there is public opposition to that. And in a democracy, you know, public opposition is important. If you had been in China, you could still continue with nuclear power on a much larger scale, and not China does have a large nuclear program, but India is struggling on basically on public opinion on that. One thing which can change on nuclear is that there are multiple technologies we are talking about which can make nuclear smaller and safer. Okay, and that research is on. Hopefully, we'll see some progress on that, because the world needs that progress, but is not willing to acknowledge the importance as of now.
So should countries the world over give a look over at nuclear technology and have a relook and change their policies to have nuclear in the energy basket?
I think the countries should set KPIs of what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. it should set the boundaries
mm.
and let the research perform within the boundaries, okay, and deliver to those. Okay, as long as that is done, then the country should encourage nuclear rather than blanket denial of nuclear, which we have seen even in technology advanced countries like Germany. You know, there's a blanket denial of on nuclear.
Yeah, they're shutting all their
shutting everything.
All their plants, right?
Yes, yeah, they're shutting all their plants. But the future may need nuclear if we have to survive.
I want to talk about one more technology which hasn't done too well and it's coming back, hydrogen. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So hydrogen is up and coming, and hydrogen has been around for a very long time. It's used, say, in refineries and fertilizer plants and so on already. Okay, it is used in some plastics and chemicals production and so on. But now we are looking at using hydrogen to, say, produce cement or produce metals, okay, which is a large energy consumer. And why are we looking at hydrogen? Because there is a possibility of using hydrogen in a clean way by producing it from, say, renewable energy and then using it as hydrogen, green hydrogen, or using natural gas, but then using carbon capture and storage to tuck away the CO2 of that, and hence using blue hydrogen, what's called blue hydrogen. And if you are using the clean hydrogen in industrial processes, then you are addressing some of the parts which are very difficult. We call these hard to abate sectors, where abatement of carbon is very difficult. But then with these new technologies, you can produce cement or metal, steel, and others, and then address those hard to abate sectors. Okay, that is the direction of hydrogen. It is not easy because it was supposed to be a technology which was over the horizon. A year ago, we used to talk of hydrogen being a 2050 technology, over the horizon. But suddenly, a lot of attention has gone to hydrogen. A lot of research is going in, and the hope is that it's now going to be here and now, not 2050, but 2030. We will start deploying clean hydrogen on a much larger scale. So that is the promise which has come. The promise has come ahead, and also very necessary, because that will be one of the technologies to address the whole carbon problem which we were talking about. So three technologies we have talked about: CCS, CCUS, which is important but which needs a lot of research to bring prices down, costs down; hydrogen, which was over the horizon but has come within the time frame, 2030, 2040 time frame now. And nuclear, which I believe that if we get the right research going in and set the right parameters for it, it can be a big part of the solution.
Finally, in my last part of this discussion, I want to talk about two things. Addressing the historical emissions. The developed nations are developed now because of the fact that they used oil and they used so-called dirty forms of energy to grow. And I want to talk a little bit about how we can address this in the future. You keep talking about developing new technology, right? So let's talk a little bit about that. So the first one would be addressing historical emissions. Is it fair to say that developed nations must bear a bigger burden in addressing climate change?
See, we make this an emotional issue. Okay, it is not an emotional issue. It's a practical issue. See, as a developing economy, be it India, be it somebody else, we have a lot of distance to cover for our well-being of our people. The minimum living standards which we have to reach. We don't need to necessarily reach Western standards, but we need to have growth, and our economies are in the state of demographics and growth, which will require energy. As I said, 5-6% growth will happen automatically. So you will need the energy for that. So we have no choice but to have dependable sources of energy. Okay, it's not about historical factors, because the moment you bring that, you bring, debates which are very difficult to resolve. But if you root that discussion in reality, that India's growth is a reality, you cannot stop that growth. Okay, even if you wanted to stop it, you can't stop that growth. Okay, so given that it will be growing and it will be requiring energy, where do we get the energy from? Okay, we can do all the renewables that we want in the world, but we'll still need fossil fuels. So what the world talks about, net zero and others, it's good to talk about in the context of developed economies. But when you see a growing economy like India, even China is a maturing economy, we will need the sources of energy. Okay, it's not that we are fascinated by coal. We are fascinated by everything which gives us energy.
Mm.
Okay, So that is the debate. That is the debate to have, saying that where do we find that energy from? Now, if you're saying, if the West is now saying that, okay, let's find new technologies, renewables coupled with CCS, CCUS, and others, fine, you know, that is okay. But then transfer the technology and transfer the funding of the technology at a point of price point which a developing nation can afford. So that's why then you need to have transfers of funds from developed nations to developing nations. And that should be of the order. In the time of the Paris Agreement, it was identified that, you know, not just to India, but to developing nations, there would be about $100 billion a year transfer of, you know, resources from the rich to the poor, so to speak. Okay. But only 3 or 4 billion per year has been happening. No, so it's minuscule as compared to what
we need. That's the problem, isn't it? The rich countries don't want to bear the burden of the legacy, if you will, or they don't want to open their purse strings in a big way to help everyone.
It's more than that. You know, you are stopping a natural flow in a developing world, okay, because of demographics and stage of the economy. If you want to change the flow because of global interest, your interest, then you have to bear the burden of that. Okay, as simple as that. Okay. And that is because, you know, that brings it back to the historical debate, but it's not a equity debate. It's a practical debate which we need to live and find practical ways to solve. The most practical way to solve this is to have the financial transfers from the rich economies to the poor economies. Let me put it that way. Because I think otherwise it just gets muddled in ideological debates, which are useless actually.
So how do we get the developed nations to fund programs in developing nations? Do we get the multinationals involved?
Yeah, you can have through multilateral banks, you can have through multinational organizations, you can have direct country-to-country transfers. So there were funds which were set up, Global Green Growth Funds and so on and so forth. Okay, there are multiple funds which were set up. They haven't seen the scale which one should be seeing. So if you want carbon capture to happen, okay, or battery storage to happen, go ahead and invest on that scale in the developing world, okay, to make sure that the renewables can be integrated or the carbon can be captured from coal-fired power plants. But that's not happened, right? So it's a little bit from the developed world, it's like a little bit of having your cake and eating it too, honestly.
So there's also another aspect, investing in developing these technologies. How much money is going into it?
There's a fair amount of money going into them. Okay, for example, on storage technologies, there's a fair amount of money which is going. On renewables itself, there is a fair amount of money which continues to go to improve, say, solar technologies. On carbon capture and storage, there are new technologies which are coming, which includes direct air capture, which is essentially sucking carbon dioxide from the air and storing it down.
Storing the ground, yeah.
Yeah, so those kinds of technologies are coming. And they have to be a part of the solution, okay? But every technology has a life cycle. It takes time, right? Even if we accelerate it, you know, you had a vaccine development period for COVID, which in normally vaccine development period, 7 years, 8 years, 10 years. You crashed it to a year, but you can't crash it to 1 month. That is, you tested the limits. So we need to test the limits, bring it down to a year, but also recognize that it won't happen a month. You know, that's so it has its own cycle.
Okay, thank you so much for joining us today, Anish, sir.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
Thank you for joining us in the BL Context. We'll meet you next time with another interesting topic.